Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning into Atlanta Legal Experts Radio Show. I am your host, Emily Rowell. We also have Rich Casanova with Buckhead Business Radio X in the background here working as a producer slash engineer today.
Good morning, Emily.
Morning.
Man, you have a great show. I'm a little bit jealous, whatever. This is going to be a great show. We've had a little conversation beforehand with some of our guests. Looking forward to it.
Thank you. Thank you. Our special guests today are Joe Rosen. Good morning.
Good morning.
Anna Sokol. And Jackie Clements.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you for being here. And they are all with Joseph H. Rosen Immigration Law Group.
What a coincidence. Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead and start with Joseph Rosen's bio. Just going to read a little bit of background on him, which is extremely impressive. Mr. Rosen is the managing attorney for Joseph H. Rosen Immigration Law Group. Mr. Rosen began practicing immigration law in June 2001 after retiring from the U.S. government, where he spent 20 years as a special agent with both the FBI and U.S. Customs. His law enforcement career included 10 years working on or near the Mexican border and 3 years working sex crimes against children. Mr. Rosen was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He received a BA in political science from American University and an M.Ed. from Bowie State University in Bowie, Maryland. After graduating Widener's Delaware Law School cum laude in 1983 as a night student, Professor Rosen entered the FBI as a special agent, retiring from the government in 2001. He has been an adjunct faculty member at Atlanta's John Marshall Law School since 2006 and teaches immigration law class and is a clinical director at the JMLS Immigration Clinic located at the Catholic Charities Atlanta. He is a past president of the North Fulton Bar Association and spoken at numerous CLE training seminars, appeared on CNN, and been interviewed by radio, newspaper, and TV news providers and the Atlanta Legal Experts radio show. We're excited to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, so our first question for you is, what got you interested in practicing immigration law?
Well, to a degree, when I retired, I really wanted to enter a legal position that I could be working with people, enjoying issues, not really involved in a lot of litigation. Mm-hmm. And at that time, 10, 12 years ago, there were extremely few attorneys working in immigration. And so I started thinking about it. My grandparents were immigrants. They had fled Russia in the early 1900s for religious persecution. They came here. When I worked on the border, there were literally just thousands of folks every day just fleeing economic situations coming to the U.S., so I became kind of familiar with it. And most of the attorneys I would talk to had said, go into immigration law. You speak Spanish, you know immigration. And coincidentally, I didn't know any Spanish, which I still don't, and I really didn't know anything about immigration. I worked drugs on the border. But the more I got into it, I just found it a fascinating area to practice in. I represent clients from about 40 countries. About a fourth of the practice are pro athletes, tennis pros, golf pros, squash pros. About a fourth are foreign businessmen coming into the U.S. to opening up businesses. And then about half the practice are U.S. citizens who are sponsoring family members, either parents, children, or spouses. So it's just been a really fascinating practice.
I bet. I bet it's definitely enlightening and lifting when you're helping other people.
It really is. And I tend to really have happy clients. We'll have the occasional client who's not thrilled with us, but, it's not a litigious practice. And so we're really helping folks all the time and really helping, almost all of our clients come in for the American dream. And it's really a rewarding practice.
I bet. I bet. That's awesome. What are the biggest misconceptions about immigration law?
Well, I think both when I teach with my students and I do a lot of speaking engagements, so I'll get a lot of questions. One of them is that most of my clients are lower income Central Americans or Mexican, which is not. The immigrant population in America is really composed of folks from all over the world. Again, my clients are from about 40 different countries. The majority of my clients tend to be middle class and upper class. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks coming into America to invest. A lot of folks from professional families overseas that are professionals themselves coming to practice in the United States. America tends to be one of those countries, one of the few in the world, where you're really not limited by your family history or your background. It also is, right. is the, the the country in the world where you can get a fresh start. You can come in, you can try things. If they don't work, they can continue to succeed. Mm-hmm. Another one tends to be that if you marry an American citizen, you immediately become an American citizen, which is not true. If someone comes in and they're here legally, they marry a U.S. citizen, it still is a process going through a green card and then citizenship that can extend over 5 or 10 years. If someone comes in and at the clinic level, for example, with Catholic Charities, it's really a very dire situation. Someone will come in, they'll walk across the border without inspection. They marry a U.S. citizen. They may have 2, 3, 4 U.S. citizen children. They still cannot get a green card. They would have to leave the country generally for almost 10 years.
Really?
So, you know, we'll have a number of clients will come in for consultations, particularly Catholic Charities. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a woman in North Georgia. She met a man. Maybe he was a landscaper. They got married. They have 2 or 3 children. And they want to legalize him so he can get a green card. And he would have to leave the country for 10 years. And as the primary breadwinner, you're leaving a U.S. citizen wife and potentially 2 or 3 children that are U.S. citizens
right.
with no income. So wow. it tends to be a real misconception that simply marrying a U.S. citizen creates a legal way for them to stay in the country.
So how long does it take if they weren't to marry when they come in originally? If they come in and then they get citizenship, like immediately, how long is that process?
Well, if someone comes in and they're here legally and mm-hmm. they marry a U.S. citizen, maybe they're a student, they're at Georgia Tech, they meet another student who's a U.S. citizen. They get married. Jackie, for example, who's a new attorney in the office, Jackie came in on a tennis scholarship, was at Clayton State, met a U.S. citizen, they got married. The application process for that, once you apply, is about 6 months to get a green card. You then have to have a green card for at least 3 years. Once you've had a green card for 3 years, as long as you're still married, at that point you could apply for citizenship. And applying for citizenship is probably a 6 to 12 month process.
Okay. That's not too bad. Especially going through all the rigmarole and the government and everything
right.
like that. Yeah.
But, and the other thing that folks tend to overlook is the expense of it also. Just the application fees to apply for a green card per person, just the filing fees to the government are $1,490. And to apply for U.S. citizenship is $690. If you have a family of 4 just to apply for citizenship, again, you're looking at almost $2,500.
Wow. Yeah. So you mentioned the clients that you represent. Is there anybody else also that you represent? I mean, do you represent the Mexican as well?
Well, yeah, no, I represent folks from all over the world. In terms of, you know, from Mexico, I represent a couple of Mexican business individuals. I represent one gentleman came in from Mexico City. He bought a franchise operation up here, invested $200,000, bought a franchise here in Buckhead that he operates.
Oh, wow.
We're currently representing another Mexican national who's involved in the funeral industry, is coming up and, you know, working with a U.S. company. And then from the other end, from the clinic in particular, we do represent a number of individuals who are married to U.S. citizens, mm-hmm. and they have this 10-year bar, and they're trying to work around that to find out what waivers are available, how they can do it. And again, those situations tend to be very difficult for the families. Mm-hmm. Because you're taking the primary wage earner, making them leave the country, and you're leaving folks here with absolutely no income.
Right. And can the borders be secured?
You know, I'm asked that question frequently, primarily because I'd worked there mm-hmm. when I was in law enforcement. And I really contend they can't. You know, I've worked on the border from El Paso, all across New Mexico, Arizona, California, and it's desert. I mean, it's hundreds right. and hundreds of miles of desert. And then you go up north. I've spent a lot of time in Montana, Washington. You get up there, you can't put military every 5 feet along the border.
Right.
And I think we're seeing that in the last week or two with this influx of Central American children that are coming in. There are thousands mm-hmm. of children coming in. And there's no way you can patrol the border to make it 100% 100% enforced. So
right.
that no one can come in. I've always maintained that it's much more a matter of interior enforcement and enforcement of working rights and ability to work and legal working conditions mm-hmm. than the border. And occasionally, you know, you hear somebody say, well, we can put the military down there. I just don't think that's what America is about.
Right, right. That makes sense. Why is immigration reform needed, and what should it look like?
Well, it's really a completely broken system at this point. The resources aren't there. The rules tend to be a mishmash of things that have existed for 30 and 40 years. If for the removal process, for example, currently, if someone is a convicted felon, four or five felonies, there's somebody who the government really is prioritizing to remove. Mm-hmm. There's so few resources that it takes about 3 years to get an individual hearing for that person to be removed. There's so few visas available right now, both in the business area and the family area, that the backlogs are just atrocious. For example, if you graduate number one from Georgia Tech with a degree in engineering and you're from China and an employer wants to hire you, if they want to hire you in a permanent position to get a green card, it's about a 12-year wait. And so you have to find some way to keep them in for 12 years. On the family side, there's also a very restricted number of visas available. So, for example, I had a client in a couple days ago from Iran, and he's a U.S. citizen. All of his family are U.S. citizens. They have one brother still in Tehran who's a Baha'i, which is a religion that is just almost routinely persecuted. Mm. Because of the limited number of visas available for brothers of U.S. citizens, it's a 12-year wait. So this guy is remaining in a position of being persecuted, living away from his family in Iran, and it'll be a 12-year wait. So one of the comments that you frequently hear is that the problem with the system is there are too many people chasing too few visas. Right. In the area of professionals, for example, we have 300,000 foreign students in the United States. We only award 65,000 visas per year for folks with professional degrees. So right now you graduate from Georgia Tech, University of Georgia, somebody wants to hire you as an architect, an engineer. There are none available at this point until October 2015. So the result is we have a lot of folks come into the United States, get an education, fill up graduate seats, and then they can't be hired here, so they leave for overseas. Bill Gates was on the Hill a number of years ago arguing that if we really want to be competitive worldwide to hire the best and the brightest, we have to increase the number of those visas. Congress refused to do it, and Bill Gates ended up opening one of his largest R&D centers in Canada just to hire U.S. college graduates so they could work in furtherance of Microsoft.
That's amazing. And so many people are coming in, but then it's so difficult. It just sounds like it's so difficult to get in the normal way. So what does that reform look like?
Well, right now it's still a patchwork. They're talking about increasing numbers. They're talking about changing the systems. Mm-hmm. In terms of the inadmissibility for being here illegally, they're talking about somehow how do you legalize folks that have been here maybe 10 years, they own businesses, they pay taxes, they have U.S. citizen spouses, they have U.S. citizen children. Instead of making them leave for 10 years, in the same way that we did in 2001, can you set up something where they pay a fine, they prove they have good moral character, and then allow them to legalize? Right. For the business and family members that want to come in legally, it's primarily a matter of being able to increase the numbers of folks coming in the United States. You have some of the groups like FAIR. FAIR even indicates, well, they're not just against illegal immigration. They want to shut down immigration completely. They don't want anyone from a foreign country coming into the United States.
Well, that's kind of how we got here, isn't it? Well, thank you so much. Those are awesome answers, and your experience is just enormous. It's wonderful. Can you tell me how the listeners can get in touch with you?
Either through the website, it's jhrosenlaw.com. If they Google my name, Joseph Rosen, immigration attorney, they can find it. Our phone number is 678-461-6046. We're also available on Skype. We have clients all around the world. We probably do Skype consultations 4 to 5 times a week.
Wow.
Our Skype username is mlawoffice, I-M-M-L-A-W, office.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And over to Anna Sokol. Thank you for being here again.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And I'm going to go ahead and read your bio. Ms. Sokol is a Polish citizen and a legal permanent resident in the U.S. Ms. Sokol has a law degree from the University of Lodz, Poland, and a Master's of Law, LLM, from Atlanta's John Marshall Law School. She is anticipating taking the Georgia State Bar in 2015. Ms. Sokol has assisted the Polish Embassy to the U.S. in registering Polish citizens in the U.S. so that they could vote in Polish national elections. She has been employed as a law clerk in the Joseph Rosen Immigration Law Group since 2006. Ms. Sokol specializes in working with foreign athletes, entertainers, and artists, foreign professionals, and U.S. businesses seeking to employ foreign professionals. Ms. Sokol is fluent in Polish, English, and Italian. All right. Well, if I could understand it, I'd ask you to speak it. What are your thoughts, having gone through the U.S. immigration process, to obtain permanent resident status in the U.S.?
Well, it's definitely a lengthy and complicated process that requires a lot of patience, that's for sure. But I think because I went through this process myself, I can probably understand our clients better. I can understand their frustrations when they have to wait years and years to obtain a permanent residency in the U.S. and mostly talking about employment-based process. So the backlog of cases is really very big in the U.S. So as Joe Rosen said before, the system currently is really broken. It just makes it really hard for professionals, for employers to keep the highly skilled workers in the U.S. So it would be nice if we could finally see some immigration reform, but I guess it has to stop being about politics, and it should be all about what's right, what's the right thing to do, and what's the good thing to do for the country.
Right, right. How does the U.S. legal system and educational process differ from the Polish system?
First of all, the legal systems of both countries stem from different legal traditions. While the U.S. law is based on a common law, the Polish laws are codified. So both private and public laws are codified. So the function of the judge is different in Poland. He's not bound really by the decisions of different courts. His decisions have to be made based on the existing codified law. Also, the legal path is a little bit different for professionals. Students choose pretty much their career path right after graduation. So you have to decide at the end of your law school whether you would like to become a judge, attorney, a legal advisor, notary. So when you have a bar trainings for several years before you can be admitted to the profession. So, so that's main differences.
What is the most difficult aspect of applying for immigration approval for foreign athletes or professionals?
Well, we talked before a little bit about the professionals and not sufficient numbers of visas being available for professional workers. So ironically, really the biggest obstacle in obtaining a non-immigrant benefit for professional worker are numerical limitations of H-1B visas. So there are only 65,000 visas available each year. And this year alone, USCIS received over 170,000 petitions. So before we can even get into the merits of the case, we have to keep our fingers crossed that our clients' petitions will be selected in the automated computerized lottery system.
Wow.
So this is really crazy. So
yeah,
when you think
like
about it. So, and U.S. employers really need highly skilled workers in order to maintain their projects and being able to have work also for U.S. workers. So I think it's a big misconception that a lot of people have, thinking that highly skilled foreign workers take jobs from Americans. I think it's actually not true, and they help create more jobs for U.S. workers.
Right. Now, how about the foreign athletes? Same thing, or is it a little bit different?
It's a little bit different. There are no like numerical limitations, although the process is also difficult because in order to obtain a visa benefit, either non-immigrant or immigrant benefit for athlete, you have to prove that this athlete is extraordinary person in their field. And sometimes the standards, they are really hard to figure out what USCIS is looking for. Like, we had clients before, we had the person who was like number 18 in the world in squash in doubles, and he was told that he's not extraordinary because that wasn't individual effort. He needed a teammate in order to be 18 in the world, and he was denied the wow. visa. So just sometimes, so sometimes you just have to deal with all those standards that are not necessarily connected to the reality. And right. just, yes.
It sounds like it was almost made up. Like they just made that up to so that he wouldn't get his citizenship.
Well, sometimes it is really difficult. And for example, for professionals, the permanent labor certification process, I think that's something that each immigration attorney is just absolutely scared of, because it's just a lot of times it's not about the merits of the case or whether the employer really needs services of this particular professional, but it's all about, you know, let's try to not approve this case because there is a comma missing, or there is, it's just a lot of time it's about technicality and not mm-hmm. about the merits. And that's the frustrating part of right. the process.
Right. Well, hopefully you guys are still working on that and getting, doing a good job.
You are.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, and to expand on what Anna said in terms of the frustration of it, we had a recent case, for example. One of the things that complicates it is how many agencies you deal with. So we had an individual who was one of the number one players at a local college here in Georgia, NCAA championships. He was hired by a local tennis club. Department of Homeland Security approved his petition to stay here and teach tennis. And he was teaching tennis here. He was here for 5 months on an approved petition. He went home for Christmas, and he had to go into the embassy, the Department of State, to get his visa to return. The embassy took the position, well, they didn't think that CIS had made the correct decision, so they refused to issue him a visa. This poor guy is home for 2 weeks. He's now been there 6 months. And the employer is trying to understand, how can this be? How can it be that, you know, this was approved by the U.S. government, and now the U.S. government is fighting amongst themselves?
Right.
And as a businessman, I have clients depending on him.
Right.
So it becomes very frustrating to try and explain, number one, to employers how bad the system is. And again, this poor guy is over in, you know, over in his home country now. He has a car here. He has an apartment here. His bank account's here. And he can't come in because there's this inner conflict between the Department of State and Department of Homeland Security over their disagreement of whether or not he should be allowed to come in.
That's unbelievable. That is unbelievable. Is there any other stories that you can explain as far as like a business or like one of your one that you've actually helped?
For difficulties of coming in, I'd rather stick on the ones that are successful. we have one company, for example, that's based out of Germany,
uh-huh.
and they have subsidiary companies around the world, including one in Canada. They purchased a construction company here in Georgia, and we were able to work with them to get what's called a blanket petition, where they can transfer executives from any of their subsidiaries or affiliates around the world and transfer them into Georgia without much of a problem.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, we also work with a couple IT companies that are taking folks that have graduated either from U.S. colleges or colleges abroad, and they're supplying contract IT expertise to companies within the U.S. We have a couple other companies that we do stuff with, that bakeries that are bringing in bakers. Mm-hmm. We have a number of, we're currently working with a guy who, it was kind of a surprise to Anna and I, we'd never come across it. He's a graphic artist, and he's a T-shirt designer. And when he first came in, we really were unaware of the extent of that kind of business. And, you know, he exhibits in galleries. He has a web presence. He's a very talented graphic artist who, when you first meet him, he says, well, I design, you know, I do designs for T-shirts.
Right.
And so we're bringing him in. We're also working currently in Europe with a married couple that were international gymnast, and they're now kind of a Cirque du Soleil act. And
oh, wow.
they have some opportunities here in the U.S., so we're working with them to obtain visas for them to come in.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm going to go ahead and introduce Jackie. Thank you again for being here with us.
Thank you for having us.
And it's Jackie Clements, and I want to go ahead and give your bio so everybody knows about you. Ms. Clements was born and raised as a citizen of Venezuela. She initially came to the U.S. as a foreign student on a tennis scholarship. She played tennis at Clayton State College, from where She also received a BA in business administration. While there, she met her U.S. citizen husband, married, received legal permanent resident status, and then U.S. citizenship. Ms. Clements was admitted to the Georgia Bar in 2014. She received her Juris Doctorate in 2013 from Atlanta's John Marshall Law School. Jackie joined the Rosen Immigration Law Group in 2010 and progressed from a legal assistant to a paralegal to a law clerk to an attorney. She is responsible for representing clients in removal proceedings, accompanying clients to green card and citizenship interviews, directly assisting clients, preparing forms and submitting them to USCIS and Department of Labor, and responding to case inquiries. Ms. Clements is fluent in both English and Spanish. Welcome.
Thank you.
What was your journey like from high school in Venezuela to becoming a U.S. citizen and a Georgia licensed attorney?
Okay. Well, I have played tennis all my life, and I had the chance to come into the U.S. on a tennis scholarship. Mm-hmm. So I came to play tennis at Clayton State University. So I came with an F1 visa, which is a student visa. And I met my husband there. And after I graduated, we got married. And I was able to go through the green card process with him. Mm-hmm. And through that process, I was able to get the citizenship. And then I decided to go to law school. And, you know, I graduated and I passed the bar about a week ago.
Yay.
And so, yes, very exciting.
Good. What is the most fulfilling part of immigration law for you?
This probably will sound like a cliche, but I think is to help other people get the American dream. Mm-hmm. I feel that a lot of our clients, they want to be productive members of society. And sometimes for some of our clients, it's harder to get that. So when we get approvals for different clients, either, you know, businesses or family through the family process, and they're able to get employment authorization card, which allow them to drive and to work, they are really, really excited about that. So for me, that is the most fulfilling, that they can work and,
right.
you know,
and
contribute. Yes, and contribute. Yes.
What is the most frustrating part? I'm sure we've talked about this already, but mm-hmm. go ahead and tell me what your version is.
Well, I agree. It's the red tape, you know, mm-hmm. because it even happened with the family part of immigration. Mm-hmm. For example, just this month, I have two applications that they look exactly the same that we file. And one of them was approved without any problem. And then the other one, USCIS wanted more documents. Mm-hmm. So the frustrating part is that sometimes it's hard to advise the client what exactly they need
right.
to get an approval. And it's frustrating sometimes to go back to the client and say, oh, they are requesting more documents, when they expect us to know what we are doing, you know?
Right.
So
right.
that is the most frustrating part, yes.
Right. You have mm-hmm. nobody to blame. Right.
Correct. Yeah. So, you know, they hire us for a reason.
Right. What surprised you the most between going through the process and helping others go through it?
I will say for my kind of situation, it can be looked at an easy situation because I got here with a visa and then I married a U.S. citizen. And that is the easy way right. for someone to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, by the time that we apply for the green card, we have had this relationship for about 5 years. So we were able to show joint documents showing that we were actually married, that we had a bona fide marriage, and mm-hmm. we were living together, and we actually had a relationship. Mm-hmm. There are some clients that apply for a green card really quick after they get married. And sometimes, even though it's a bona fide marriage, it's hard for them to prove it.
Okay.
And
yeah.
that can create problems because you, for immigration, you have to do everything through documents.
Sure.
So,
sure.
So that my process was easy. And I guess I did not understand that until I started working.
Right. You know, why isn't this happening? This was easy for me, mm-hmm. and now it's really difficult for everybody else, mm-hmm. right? Or
yes.
a lot of other people, yes. not everybody, but yeah. So, well, that's very interesting. Everything just seems so backwards. That's just all I can think of when mm-hmm. I'm listening to the stories. It just seems very backwards.
And to expand on what Jackie said in terms of the documents, we had a client come in a day or so ago, for example, and I really had to explain to him, immigration doesn't really care if you're married. They care about, do you have documents showing you're married? This gentleman is a professional. He's married to a professional. Because of the job market, he's currently working in Atlanta, and his wife is a licensed professional in South Carolina. Well, because of that, he has an apartment here. She has a home in South Carolina, and all their documents show that they're living apart when, in fact, he travels up there every weekend. Well, immigration's requirement is you have to be living together. So that's going to be a real burden for us to be able to just convince them that, well, look, even though they're living separately, which is very common in a two-professional family like this,
right.
that they still are married.
Mm-hmm.
Immigration will just look at it very quickly and just say, hey, you're married.
Wow. So how can you prove that?
The way we're documenting it is his bank accounts, for example, he has a bank account here. And one of the things I advised him was just simply change your address on the bank account. You can have a bank in South Carolina, have it mailed to your home address. For your car insurance, make sure you both have car insurance for this, you know, on the same policy.
Mm-hmm.
For your utility bills, you can have your utility bills here and there. Get affidavits from your family. For your job, his job, he has a temporary job. He's on a year-to-year contract. He expects to keep it only for 3 years. Mm-hmm. So get a letter from your employer showing that you're really here on a temporary basis. He goes home every weekend and sees the children, mm-hmm. pictures of him and his children. He's involved as a coach for one of his kids' athletic teams, a letter documenting that. We had another similar situation about a year ago. Husband was living up here in Atlanta. His wife was a medical student at the Medical College of Georgia in Augusta. Mm. So she had an apartment in Augusta. She was enrolled in school in Augusta, but they were still married and she came home every weekend. So it was really simply a matter of documenting that.
Mm-hmm.
We made sure that her school records had her address of record as the Atlanta address versus the Augusta address.
Right.
But immigration approaches that simply as, well, your documents show you don't live together, so obviously you're not married.
That's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. Well, let's skip over to the business side, if you don't mind me asking a couple questions
sure.
for you and your business. Basically, I see that you're practicing in Roswell. Do you have clients all over the city? Sounds like you do from what you said.
Yeah, we really have clients worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
From throughout the city, we even have a number of clients, business clients from Thomasville that'll come up from Thomasville and mm-hmm. they'll drive up once a month. We'll see them
mm-hmm.
Really from all over the state of Georgia. And again, additionally, we have clients throughout the world.
Of course.
Anna had mentioned that we represent squash pros. We probably represented the top 20 squash players in the world. We probably represent 10 of them. And we represent probably 40 or 50 squash pros, none of whom are in Georgia. They're all
right.
all tend to be in New England. And
okay.
And so, you know, the clientele really is all over the world. It tends to be a worldwide practice.
Gotcha. And that's why you have the Skype.
Yes. Yeah. I, you know, 10 years ago, I never would have anticipated that number one, I would use Skype, or number two, that I would use it as much as I do.
Right. As for your business. Right. Right. So I saw that you were part of a referral group in the past and wanted to find out more about how much of your business do you get from referrals?
Yeah.
And networking?
Well, kind of a combination. I joined when I first started practicing. It was a real transition. I came from law enforcement where our measure of success was how many people did you handcuff and convict to right. suddenly I'm in a situation where how can I attract clients and have people come in and pay me to represent them? And I had a friend who was in Power Corps, which is a lead referral group.
Mm-hmm. Local here.
And mm-hmm. yeah, and I ended up joining Power Corps almost the second week of my practice. And for the first 4 to 5 years, I probably got 20% of my gross revenues from Power Corps referrals.
That's
and
huge.
It was, you know, it was a small group. And what I was doing really was not so much marketing to the people in the group as much as teaching the 20 people in the group what I did, and they would then market for me essentially. Because mm-hmm. most people, I think, find attorneys by asking their friends. If
right.
you need a divorce, you have a bankruptcy, you have an immigration issue, they'll ask friends where they found their attorney. And if you happen to know someone, and then I think one of the things I learned the most from that too was I really never introduced myself as an attorney. I introduced myself as an immigration attorney and really let people know I'm involved in immigration. Right. You know, and I was with PowerCorp probably about 10 years.
Wow.
And at this point, you know, I've had the practice about 12 years. I got into a discussion with a student in one of my classes. Mm-hmm. He was saying that he works with a criminal defense firm. And he was talking about how much they hate their clients and how they really look forward to their clients just having the case done. And my comment was, well, that's why I enjoy immigration law. I tend to have clients for life. You know, I have a client right now who I started representing her. She was a tennis professional. She had played for Mercer. She got an O-1 visa as an employee. She worked for a very large tennis organization. Then she got her green card. Then she got citizenship. Then she applied for her mother to come to the United States. She applied for her husband. I've represented her for 12 years.
Right.
And so I tend to get a lot, probably 50 to 70% of our business, probably 50 to 70% of our business is from referrals from prior clients.
Sure.
And
sure.
So much of that really started through this lead referral group.
Yes, that's awesome. Speaking of your classes, you were talking about what, I know you teach obviously the immigration law class. What levels of students are you teaching? Are you teaching the beginner students, you know, or?
The class involves second and third year law students.
Okay.
And the immigration clinic that I co-lead down at Catholic Charities involves mm-hmm. third year law students. And it's an interesting mix. And part of it, I think, is the makeup of John Marshall. This year, I have 12 kids in my summer school class, and I think they represent 11 countries.
Oh, wow.
And I'd say out of the 11, probably 9 of them are immigrants to the United States, or we have one kid, well, kid, he's probably in his mid-30s, who was born in Bolivia to a U.S. citizen parent. But it's really a very mixed group of folks that have been through an immigration process themselves.
Right.
I think also with the job market for attorneys being what it is right now, mm-hmm. it's very difficult to be hired by a law firm. So a lot of folks are looking to open up their own practices.
Right.
And immigration law tends to be one of those areas where it's very easy to go in and open up your own practice and not have to be affiliated with other attorneys.
Right.
One of the things I do at the law school every September, October, is run a boot camp for new solo practice attorneys. And I think at this point I have about 40 graduates in the last 7 or 8 years that all have their own immigration law practices now.
Wow. That's awesome. Rich?
Yeah, very good stuff. I'm thinking about actually joining a squash team just so I can get Joe to represent me or whatever. But actually, I'm a semi-amateur chess player. I don't know if you have any spots open for that or not yet.
Well, we don't, but the visa category is exceptional and extraordinary ability. And we've represented folks from, you know, such a broad spectrum. I mean, we'll have athletes. We spoke to one guy a few years ago who was obtaining a green card as a sake expert. He was one of the top 12 folks licensed by Japan with expertise in sake. And he'd been employed here in the United States by a distillery as an expert in sake. And he would travel around the United States to bars and restaurants giving presentations on the different levels of sake.
Wow.
So
that's awesome.
Yeah, so there's,
well, once again, I'm just an amateur with sake, but yeah.
Yes. You know, probably wouldn't get you into the U.S. with
right,
that level
exactly,
then.
Yeah.
It's good for the AL radio show.
Yeah, exactly. For AL radio, that's perfect, whatever. Yeah. Yeah, I've met a handful of immigration attorneys, but never thought about it's very interesting y'all's involvement with athletes and entertainment. And mm-hmm. Imagine spending a day or two at their office, whatever, right?
I know. Yeah. I know. It's probably incredible.
It's fascinating. You know, and then there are other aspects of the practice that folks just aren't aware of. We do some stuff outbound. For example, one of the things that we get involved with, and we're involved with a couple different entertainers right now on it, unknowns to most Americans, you're inadmissible to Canada if you have a DUI at any point in your life.
Really?
Yeah. And if you go on the Canadian website, they're very clear about it. I'm going on a fishing trip in August to British Columbia, and the owner of the lodge right up front told us, if anybody in your group ever had a DUI, they can't get into Canada. And
wow.
You have to obtain what's called a Certificate of Rehabilitation from the Minister of Health of Canada. So, you know, with entertainers, occasionally they may
sure.
have a conviction for something.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we'll do is assist them in, and it's about, we just had one approved recently. It took 2 years.
Oh, my goodness.
We at one point represented somebody who was a relatively high official in state government who was invited to attend a conference in Canada and was denied admission because he had a DUI a number of years ago.
Wow.
So how does Rob Forbes, the mayor of Toronto, get away with that?
Well, he's not coming into Canada.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
It's different standards.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
You know, the question becomes, how does Justin Bieber get into the United States?
Yeah.
And eventually that could become an issue. You know, if he's eventually convicted of anything, it'll make him inadmissible to the United States.
Wow.
And the other side, we're representing a woman right now on a non-immigrant visa. There are a lot of things in the United States that if you do them, you're inadmissible for life. So this woman's in her, you know, late 40s probably. She was in the United States in her 20s, acquired a conviction. She's now, you know, a very successful mother. She has children in universities here in the United States.
Sure.
She and her husband own property in the United States. But she has a 25-year-old conviction that she needs to obtain a waiver at this point. Otherwise, she's a lifetime bar.
Wow.
So it's, and you know. And
that's doable? You guys can work on that and make that happen somehow?
Yeah, it's a matter of being able to show the equities. I mean, you know, luckily the United States is not a country where, you know, you're held accountable for your entire life for a discretion as in your youth.
Right.
With the Canadian situation, we had a case of a professional stockbroker, mid-30s, who had a conviction that dated back to, I believe, University of Georgia days. You know, a DUI or a minor in possession, you know, 15 years ago as a college student will keep you out of Canada now as a professional.
Wow.
So, wow. I have one more question
for
your business. How many referrals do you get from other attorneys?
A number.
And what types of attorneys do you work with?
I tend to work with criminal attorneys. I tend to work with divorce attorneys and with estate attorneys. And all of them are different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
With criminal attorneys, depending on what you're convicted of, what you're sentenced to, and how the plea is crafted, you will or will not be deportable from the United States. Divorce attorneys, a lot of times, I've done some pro bono cases with abused women.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have a woman who's here. Her husband is the primary beneficiary of the visa, and they get a divorce. Frequently, she may have to leave the country because they're divorced and she no longer has an independent way to stay. A lot of folks will have a green card based on marriage. They get divorced and they're concerned, how does this affect my green card?
Right.
For the estate attorneys, the estate attorneys' referrals tend to be long-time legal permanent residents. And I had one couple that were, I believe, in their 80s, and they were from, I believe, the United Kingdom. Both came to the United States, worked here, retired, had U.S. citizen children. They were having their will done, and their attorney explained to them that by not being U.S. citizens, they were foregoing an exemption of, I believe it was $500,000 that would become taxable because they were not U.S. citizens. So they were referred to me to get U.S. citizenship as part of their estate planning prior to, prior to completing their wills.
Wow. Well, wonderful. And I just wanted to thank everybody again. I guess that wraps up the show today. Good show.
We can't go another hour or whatever.
I could listen to these stories forever. Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. 80 years old and they're just facing that issue at that point. How long have they been here?
Oh, they've been here, I believe, almost 30 or 40 years. Long enough to have served an entire time in careers and been able to retire.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, and the dual citizenship always comes up. I mean, folks are loyal to their own country.
Yeah.
They become reluctant to accept U.S. citizenship, even though there is dual citizenship available for a lot of folks. And, eventually some of them get around to it. Their countries pass new laws allowing dual citizenship, or they just decide that it's an appropriate thing to do.
Yeah, I'm just curious, what percentage of countries you deal with that offer dual citizenship ballpark? That's probably a tough question because it changes so often.
Yeah,
right?
The majority do.
Majority, okay.
there are a few that don't. India does not. And we really have a large Indian population in the United States.
Yeah.
China and Japan, I think primarily the Asian countries do not. Most of the European countries do allow it.
Yeah.
Australia did not till about 3-4 years ago, and then they changed their law in Australia to allow dual citizenship. The UK allows it. South Africa allows it.
What do you attribute that to? Just so many athletes and people we're becoming a much smaller world these days, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people traveling and want to do business and trade.
Yeah, I think nowadays the leaning in the direction towards dual citizenship just becomes a matter of the flattening of the world.
Yeah.
Historically, they didn't want it just because you had this concept of sovereign allegiance, where you could only have an allegiance to one sovereign. You know, the sad part is you go back in history, most of the U.S. law on immigration is based on what were called the Asian laws, and they were primarily anti-Chinese laws. And what they were based on was the belief in the United States that if you were Asian, you had a sovereign allegiance to the Emperor of China, the Emperor of Japan, and right. you could never have an allegiance to the United States. That carried all the way up to the 1940s when you had wow. folks of U.S. citizenship that were Japanese being placed in internment camps.
Yeah.
So this whole concept of sovereign allegiance had a big carryover into dual citizenship.
Good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we'll re-wrap the show up.
That was an extra bonus segment for our listeners, yeah.
And it's free.
Yeah, it was.
I wanted to just have you repeat how our listeners can get in touch with you one more time, and then I'll wrap up the show.
Yeah, our website is jhrosen, R-O-S-E-N, law.com, or they can call 678-461-6046. Or on Skype, it's mlawoffice, I-M-M-L-A-W, office.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you so much for listening. Tune in next week for an actual ale lawyer. We're excited about that. This show was brought to you by offices at 1100 Peachtree with 4 locations in Atlanta and on the web at offices1100.com. That's offices1100.com. This is Emily Rowell, your host, signing out. Thank you.